This message was recorded live at Lighthouse Christian Center in Puyallup, Washington, and is designed to inspire and encourage you in your Christian journey. To find out more about Lighthouse, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org.
You guys, I don't know if you have ever used some common item, household item, for something other than its intended purpose. When I'm doing something around the house, I don't like to go make multiple trips to the garage. So, yes, on occasion, I have used the end of a screwdriver as a hammer, okay? And yes, this it's usually curved, so it doesn't do a very good job, but I use it anyway, okay? Have any of you ever used a sharp knife as a can opener? Anybody here done that? Yeah, kids do not try this at home, okay? It's not a smart move, really. But when you have the can of peaches, you want to open it, you do the best you can. I talked about this last night. My wife was over just cringing. She told me later, I never saw you do that. I said, that's because I'm smart enough not to do it in front of you. You're a smart person, a wise person. You would never allow me to do that, honey. So that's what's going on. I guess what I'm really saying is that everything has a purpose. When you use it for that purpose, it does pretty well. But when you misapply that item, when you use it in a different way that wasn't intended, it doesn't go very well. And I'm using this humble metaphor today to help us think about marriage, especially the purpose of marriage. Because when we don't understand the purpose or really purposes of marriage, and we misapply the institution the way God has set it up. We try to use it in ways that God never intended. We try to get something from it that perhaps God is saying is not the most important thing. When we look to marriage to supply these misapplied purposes, it tends to end up not going very well. So I want to ask a couple questions about marriage today. I want us all to, by the end of this message, be thinking about, okay, these are two of God's intentions for marriage. These are His purposes. And I want us to commit to those purposes. Because when we commit to the principles found in God's Word around marriage, man, there's a lot of power to improve your marriage relationship. Or there's power there to help you when you do get married. Okay? Now, on your outline, I've listed several books that are resources for this whole series. In this first message, I want you to know that I rely heavily on Timothy Keller's book, The Meaning of Marriage, for some key ideas I'm going to communicate. So let's first ask these questions that are going to help us understand God's purposes for marriage. First question is this. Why is marriage, which is the most important human relationship on planet Earth, why is it in decline? And some of you are asking, well, Art, is it really in decline? Well, it just so happens that it is. In a book called State of Our Unions, Marriage in America, a guy named Bradford Wilcox talks about the leading marriage indicators in America. And what he says is, for the last 40 years, all the statistical measurements of the health of marriage have been going down. And I've listed three there for you on the outline. The first is the divorce rate. The divorce rate today is twice what it was in 1960. Second, in 1979, 89% of all children born in America were born to married parents. Today, that's fallen to 60%. That means 40% of the children being born today are being born without the benefit of married parents. And here's the kicker. The third stat that will astound you. 72% of American adults were married in 1962. And today, and well, 2008 was the last statistic that I looked at, only 50% were married. So yes, friends, the institution of marriage is in decline. Why? That's the question. Well, Timothy Keller gives us a couple of ideas. First is this. It's the wrong assumption held by often it's younger adults who have these misperceptions. It's the wrong assumption that most marriages are unhappy. Now, guys, in fact, I want to know about your marriage relationship right now. So let's take an anonymous poll. Here's how we'll do it. On the screen, you see a telephone number there, 62953. I want you to get out your text phones right now. Get out your telephones right now. I want you to text me. Back. Okay. This is not, go back to the one just before it. There we go. I want you to text that number, and I want you simply to put A for very satisfied, B for satisfied, and C for less than satisfied, and you'll see those stats begin to come up as you text right now. Come on, don't let somebody beat you out. Get your phone out if you're married, and you text right now. Now, somehow in our culture, this idea is out there, especially among younger adults, that there are few happy marriages. People today, people live together today for a very important reason. They think, well, we got to live together because we don't know if marriage is going to work out because nobody, hardly anybody is happy when they're married. And so they say, we got to find out whether we're compatible. We've got to find out whether there's sexual chemistry and other kinds of chemistry. We've got to live together because, after all, marriage is so difficult and we don't know anybody who's happy in marriage. Well, friends, I have some good news for you, okay? And here's the good news. First, it's true that marriage does have a high rate of divorce today. However, the large percentage of those divorces happened to people who dropped out of high school, who married before they were 18, and who had a baby before they were married. Okay? So if you grow up in a Christian home, if you get education, if you don't drop out of high school, marriage divorce rate goes way, way down. If you don't have a baby before you're married, way down. And by the way, if you look here at the stats so far, I don't know, is this in? Is this it, Shan? Okay, so more are coming in. It's going to be somewhere in 66% here say very satisfied, another 26% satisfied, 9% less than satisfied. Now, what does that mean? Okay, 91% saying satisfied or very satisfied. Now, if you're in the 9% there, I have a little bit of good news for you too. The good news is that if you're having trouble in your marriage, this researcher's study who study marriages over several years, what they say is this. If you're saying that I'm not satisfied right now, if you wait 3 to 5 years, most people say now they are satisfied if they don't divorce. But what happens is you get dissatisfied, you get a divorce, and now you don't have the capability of becoming satisfied later on, do you? Now, you know what the national stats are here? When researchers do statistics on, they query non-believers, people who don't know God. Do you know what? 61 to 62% always say the same thing. We're very satisfied in our marriage. We're very happy in our marriage. So guys, what am I saying? I'm saying, man, this assumption is wrong. Listen, young person, if you're single, you're a young person, listen very carefully. Most marriages are happy ones. Most marriages are not unhappy. The assumption is simply wrong. And you've got to know that cohabitation is very much, that is living together, is very much inferior to marriage, and in fact is a marriage killer. According to researchers David Popino and Barbara Whitehead, quote, a substantial body of evidence indicates that those who live together before marriage are more likely to break up after marriage. In other words, the cure for a bad marriage, supposedly cohabitation, is worse than the disease. Research indicates that one of the reasons that cohabitation is so destructive is that it gives a young man sexual and domestic perks without commitment. It's a ripoff for the young woman who often wants the relationship, okay? So it is not a good thing. Keller suggests a couple of reasons for the decline of marriage, the first being this wrong assumption, which I think he's right about. But the second reason I think is even more foundational. Why are marriages in decline? The second reason is this. The second reason for decline is the shift of our culture's understanding of the purpose of marriage. And now we're coming to a very important reason why marriage is taking a hit. Because the biblical purpose or purposes of marriage have not been understood. And here's where we get back to that humble analogy. When you use a screwdriver as a hammer, it doesn't work very well. And when you use marriage for a purpose in which it was not intended, it does not work very well. So let's talk about the culture's current understanding of marriage. Researchers tell us that the current ideas in America about marriage probably started in the 18th, 19th century, where the idea of marriage began to change from a place of self-denial, a place of sacred bond, and voluntary giving up freedoms, and that began to change, and it began to be redefined as finding emotional and sexual fulfillment and self-actualization. Now, guys, that term self-actualization is just a fancy way of saying you're committed to your reaching your full potential, okay? So the idea of marriage began to change. People are now saying, you know what, my marriage should give me sexual fulfillment, emotional fulfillment. Not only that, it should needs to help me reach my full potential. Well, guys, by the way, marriage, I hope that all your marriage are doing some of those things for you, that there is fulfillment, that there is sexual and emotional fulfillment, all those things. But guys, if you say to yourself, that is the premier reason why I'm married, then if it's not there, guess what's going to happen? Time to bail. Time to go, okay? Now it's a contract that people in America see marriage as a contract, and it's there for my growth and for my satisfaction, okay? These ideas that have been growing are now in full bloom in America, because in America today, marriage is just a private arrangement for my satisfaction. Timothy Keller makes the point that marriage used to be about us, but now it's about me. And what has happened is that since it's mostly about me, then a marriage partner brings enormous expectations, unrealistic expectations to the marriage. Again, David Popino and Barbara Whitehead authored a study. Here's the name of the study. Are you ready? Why Men Won't Commit. Okay? All the women are going, yeah, tell me. You know what they found? Men told them over and over again in the study that they wouldn't marry until they found, now get this, they wouldn't marry until these young men found the perfect soulmate. Think about that. Someone who is very compatible. And what they meant by compatible, what do younger adults mean by compatible? What they mean is someone whose physical attractiveness and sexual chemistry is what I want. So, you know, that's what's compatible for me. So, by the way, if you marry a compatible person who you think is hot, and then they gain 50 pounds and they're no longer hot, that means that they're not compatible. That means it's time to bail. Okay? This study also mentioned one more important element of a compatibility, and that this is especially for men. Talked about for men. Here's what it is. I quote, more than one of the men in this study expressed resentment at women who try to change them. Some of the men described marital compatibility as finding a woman who would, quote, fit into their life. In fact, one young man actually said to the researchers, if you are truly compatible, man, then you don't have to change. What a hoot! I mean, are you kidding? Because that's at the very heart of marriage, changing in ways that honor God and demonstrate love to your spouse. Friends, younger men and women see marriage differently today, and they see it primarily as a way of receiving sexual, emotional satisfaction, that those are the biggest purposes of marriage, and that if I'm not getting that, you know, that'll be a big deal. Guys, think about the self-centeredness of that way of looking at it. Do you see how destructive that would be in marriage? Do you see how unrealistic it is? Guys, marriage is about two flawed individuals coming together to try to learn to love each other in a way that will honor God. And, you know, and there are going to be plenty of mistakes along the way. In fact, there's going to be some of us who have some deep flaw that we're working on, but we still keep making mistakes in that relationship. And so if marriage is simply about emotional and sexual fulfillment, then I'm going to be pretty hacked about that if my partner is not perfect. What happens? And by the way, what about life itself? What about when a young woman has a baby and she can't have sex for a while? What happens when money is so scarce and so you haven't had a date in 6 months? What happens when you're slogging through young children and you're both half exhausted all the time? Okay? Well, in our present culture's view, you consider bailing at that point. So what's the cure for this decline, guys? And the cure is this: a biblical understanding of the purposes of marriage. It's opting out of the culture. Young Christians, single Christians, please listen carefully. You got to opt out of the culture's view of marriage. You got to say, you got to stiff arm that way of thinking. And you got to see marriage from God's perspective. Don't buy into the culture. And married couples, listen to me. Don't contemplate divorce because your spouse isn't all you want them to be. Don't do it. Most of all, friends, the solution is about clinging to what God has revealed in His Word about marriage. So let's ask the second question then. What are God's purposes for marriage? What does our Creator intend? What's His design? Why is marriage important to God? What has He said in His Word? Now, and to begin this, let me ask you a question. What is being married important? Why is being married important to you? You can text to the same number. Text the words, three words in front of it, because that cues the text where it should go. But you don't have to be married to do this. You can do it as a single. You can say, here's why marriage is, why being married is important. If you're married, put something in. We'll look at it later. Now, you know, I can remember, by the way, I was formally engaged to my wife Naomi for 18 months. Okay? I had a little calendar with 18 boxes on it. Okay? And I would cross those boxes off. And I can tell you that as a virgin, I thought that there was one purpose that was more important than anything. But I learned later that maybe it wasn't the most important thing. Let's talk then about God's purposes for marriage, okay? Marriage, and here it is. God's purpose, marriage's purpose is to guarantee present and future love. Now, I'm going to explain this. You think, I haven't seen that before. I'm saying it in a different way to get you to think, okay? I'm going to explain this. Now, I've sat with people who were cohabitating who said to me, I don't need a piece of paper to love my partner. True. But this kind of statement shows a misunderstanding of love. What they're saying is, I can feel romantic love without a piece of paper. And they're right. You can feel passion, romantic love without a piece of paper. Of course, and by the way, Christians also benefit by that romantic love and passion. But the Bible doesn't define love as in primarily that way. In fact, I've given you a definition of love in your outline. Love in the Bible is primarily a sacrificial commitment to the good of the other worked out in action. So turns out that love is far more about action than about emotion. And in fact, Paul's classic description of love in 1 Corinthians tells that like it is. What does it say? Love is patient. Love is kind. It's not jealous or conceited or proud. It's not ill-tempered, selfish, irritable. Love does not keep a record of wrongs. So guys, it's been observed over and over and over again that these descriptions don't describe primarily emotions. These descriptions of love describe primarily actions. Let's just take one of them, patience. You guys, if I'm impatient, you would know it. You would know it in my body language. You'd know it in my expressions. You'd know it in my words. You'd know it in my unkindness to you and what I said. Guys, patience is a series of actions. And when you do those actions, you are demonstrating love. And look at all the descriptions there, guys. When the Bible speaks of love, it's not thinking primarily of how much you receive. It's thinking of how much that you give. Now, here's what you should know. Husbands and wives, if you're married, listen carefully. Or if you think you will be married, listen carefully. You see this description of love in 1 Corinthians 13? Husbands and wives are held to this standard. This standard. How do I know that? Because in Ephesians 5, look what it says. Husbands, love, same word. love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for. And in Titus 2, wives are referred to as well. Train the young women to love their husbands. Now notice that both of these passages say that love is conveyed in actions that you demonstrate or not. Your decision. Look what it says. Husbands, love your wives just like Jesus loved the church. How did he love her? He demonstrated how much he loved her by giving himself for her. It says, and then it says to wives, well, train those wives. Train? How can you train somebody to have a feeling? You can't. You can't train to have a feeling. You train them to demonstrate love in a way that is clearly words, actions, attitudes. So how does this work out in daily life, man? It works out this way. Every married couple will tell you how it works out. Whether you're feeling a lot of love right now at the moment or not, you choose to demonstrate love. Okay, you don't at this moment have a lot of warm, affectionate feelings for your spouse, but you choose loving actions. And you ask God to do everything it takes in you to help you to do that. So instead of blowing up, you're angry. Instead of blowing up, you stay calm and you speak directly. Instead of taking the, excuse me? Excellent sound man. Thank you, Chuck. So instead of taking the biggest piece of the pie, like we all are wont to do, we give it to our spouse. You guys, I quoted Ephesians 5:25 that tells husbands to love their wives, but Paul goes on. He said, well, just in case you didn't get it, husband, let me tell you one more time. Look what he says in 28. Husbands should love their wives. You see that word should? It means ought. It means that you are under obligation. It means that you owe this to your wife. It's a duty. Okay, your wife is being a pill. Your wife is being very irritating. But husbands, you're under obligation to do whatever's best for her. That's love. You know, I love my wife for all kinds of reasons, many of them having to do with emotion. But primarily, the most important deal is I love my wife because I'm under obligation to love her. It's a duty to love her. And I will make that happen with all that is within me, okay? Now, I see a few things up here. I think they're up here on, now remember you texted, I'm, you know, what's important to me in my marriage, someone I trust, I'm secure to love and grow old with, my best friend, great. Having a person committed to me, growing with me physically, emotionally, spiritually, talking about lifelong partnership, that's great. To make two as one for his purpose, great, because that brings God into the picture, that's great. To help mold me into the image of Christ, oh man, yeah, we'll talk about that. Okay, good. Learning self-control, discipline, and more about how God loves. Yeah, you see the little trend going on here. Yeah, more. We are able to support each other, help each other grow. We're better together than we are apart. Yeah, no question about that. That partnership makes a huge difference. Serve God, demonstrate his love. Yes. One more. Love and security. One more. There we go, one more. God's plan, love one another, support. Yeah, all kinds of things. Yeah, we'll just let it run. We'll just let it run, and while I'm talking here, there'll be more. Guys, what do you, something went up there that was interesting? Okay, yeah. I can see that maybe I'm going to have to control this crowd by keeping those off or something. I don't know, yeah. Guys, what happens in our culture, though, is over time, because of the culture's view of romance, is that when the feeling isn't there, it's time to bail. And no, I just won't be there. In fact, sometimes I've heard, guys, sometimes a man who wants to marry another woman will say to his wife, I never loved you. And you know what happens when I hear that? I think, oh, you never loved her? That means you failed to be a Christian. In this relationship, you failed to do what God told you to do. You told her that she wasn't lovable, and therefore you didn't love her. No, no, no. It's about you loving her. Don't get me started. Okay, now, you know, when Naomi was 15, my wife Naomi, she was 15, and I was 17. We started going to each other. Now, by the way, if there are any children in the place here, that's not right. We did the wrong thing there. Just want you to know that so your parents will feel better. Okay. Now, but we did go together. I was 15. She was 15. I was 17. Now, we knew we were going to get married within 6 months. And we knew we had to wait so a while, but we knew we were going to get married within 6 months of going with each other. So, we never told our parents, of course. One day we had a beautiful conversation. We said, you know what? We love each other. How can we be better for each other? I mean, how can we change to help each other? How can, because we want to do the best by each other. What can we do? So we said, just tell me anything that you think needs to be changed. Neither one of us could think of one thing. Pretty dumb, huh? Yeah. But believe me, that's pretty similar to many couples who are about to be married. It's like, oh, you're so beautiful. You know, they're kind of starry-eyed a little bit, okay? But as time goes on, we see each other's flaws. And if those flaws continue, what does our culture say? What does our culture say about this? Get out. Or if you can't get out, simply give up, okay? But friends, marriage purpose is to guarantee present and future love. Think about what it says in Genesis 2:24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. See that word, that phrase, hold fast? In older translations of the Bible, that's translated cleave, and cleave comes from a Hebrew word that's very strong. It's talking about super glue, getting super glued to something, okay? And in fact, when you look up the word cleave and you look at all the instances of the word cleave, you see in the Bible, this phrase means to unite through a covenant or a binding promise. So to cleave to your wife means to enter in a covenant relationship with your spouse. Man, marriage is a covenant relationship. Now, some of you who haven't followed the Lord very long and you don't know about covenants, but I'll tell you about it in a moment, but Malachi 2:14 tells us the same thing. Look what it says. A man is reminded that his wife is your companion and your wife by covenant. A covenant is a binding promise made before God. So friends, that is why in a Christian wedding, we stand before family and friends, but especially before God, and we do two things. Guys, some of you are going to have great weddings. It's going to have music. It's going to have light. It's going to be beautiful. But everything in that wedding is irrelevant, except that it's enjoyable. It's irrelevant, except for two things. The two things that happen in a marriage ceremony. One, the bride and groom are asked questions. And two, the bride and groom make vows. That's it. And the questions that are asked are beautiful. Will you receive this woman as your wedded wife, complete as God intended from the beginning? Will you love her as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her? Will you defend her from physical and spiritual harm? Will you pray for her daily? Will you make a home where God is honored? And will you forsake all others so long as you both shall live? And the person says, I will. And when they say, I will, who are they talking to? They talking to the pastor? No, they're talking to God. They are making a promise to God. I will. I will love. I will do it. And then after they promise to God, what do? They turn and they vow to each other. You know? And that vow is so beautiful. I take you, Naomi, to be my wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better or worse, for richer or poor, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish, so long as we both shall live. It's hard for me to speak those vows without tearing up a little bit because they're so meaningful to me. We promise God and then we vow to each other. Now, of course, there are things in life in which people forsake those vows. And I understand, you know, I can't go into all the caveats, but marriage's purposes is to guarantee present and future love. And that's the guts of a marriage ceremony. You enter into a covenant by making promises to God. God, I promise you to love this person. It doesn't matter what happens, I promise you. And then you promise the person, I am going to love you regardless of what happens. And Jesus affirms this in Matthew 19, So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. That joining together is a mystery. How does God do that? He forms us into one unit. But I do know this, when he does it, he says that's a guarantee of present and future love. Guys, we don't have the luxury of falling out of love because we vowed not to. We don't have that luxury. We vowed not to. And if we will stick with the Lord in this, he will help us. You know, I just talked to my father-in-law yesterday, long phone call. My mother-in-law, her name is Dora. She's had Alzheimer's the last 15 years, so my father-in-law, Ken, has been ministering to her for 15 years. And really, and she was in the home for 14 of those years. Just last year, she had to go into home because she's in the last stages. And I talked to him about how his covenant relationship with his wife had kept him right where he needed to be to do whatever needed to be done for her good. It was a beautiful thing. So guys, listen, think about it. You get, of course, all those perks come. Man, that's a part of a good marriage. Of course you're fulfilled. Of course there's sexual passion there. Of course all those, but what are you doing? The purpose, you guarantee, you get married, you guaranteed present and future love. There's a second purpose, and this is one that you don't often hear. And this is coming from I'll tell you in a moment where it's coming from. But here's the purpose. Marriage's purpose is to provide the environment for spiritual growth, especially learning how to love. Now, there's a book by Gary Thomas called Sacred Marriage. And the subtitle of the book is, What If God Designed Marriage to Make Us Holy More Than to Make Us Happy? I hate that, don't you? What if God designed marriage more to make us holy than to make us happy? Now, some of you are saying, but Art, isn't marriage about those happiness things, companionship and friendship and sexual expression and children and stability? Yeah, it is. But even more fundamental is what God is doing in our hearts to transform us through that relationship. He's shaping us. He's growing us. Now, how does God use marriage to grow your inner life? You're saying, all right, how does that happen? Well, it's very simple. In the day-to-day workings of marriage, we are confronted with our own ugly attitudes, selfishness, self-centeredness, and immaturity. Are we not? Are we not? We are. And we begin to see that the main barrier to a great marriage is our own sinful heart. There it is. Can we admit that? Can you admit that at 3 a.m. when the baby is crying and you don't want to get up, that you might be tempted to feign sleep so that your spouse will get up, you know? I mean, admit it, okay? Self-centeredness is an amazing cancer in some marriages, but it's present in all marriages. Present in all marriages. So couples go to seminars learning how to communicate or how to resolve conflict. Those are good things, but it never solves the deeper problems. And I tell couples that, listen, of course we can work on skills, but you better be looking inward here. You better be saying, where's your heart? And you better be willing to submit it to the grace of God or forget getting any better. It's just not going to happen. Now, what's the scriptural basis for this issue of marriage being so transforming? Well, here it is. If you look at all of the Bible, I would argue that all the Bible commands every believer to view the challenges of his or her particular life as a platform for growth. Think about what Paul said in Philippians 4. I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am in. What is he saying by that? He is saying, view the challenges of your life, even the pain in it, view this situation as the way to grow. Paul tells slaves to serve their masters. What is he saying? View the challenge of being a slave, view the challenge of the situation as an impetus to grow as a believer by obeying God. Jesus told you that when someone, he told me that when someone hurts you, you should learn to love and forgive them. What's he saying? View the challenges of your life situation as an opportunity to grow in a way that honors God. Guys, the environments we live in are the places that God uses to grow us. How does he do it? He unmasks our sin. That's how he does it. He unmasks it. Now, single or married, this works for you, man. He unmasks your sin. And since marriage brings you into the most intense proximity to another human being that you can possibly be, since it does that, man, that means God will use that particular relationship to grow your life. In fact, man, that's his plan. The implication here is so clear. If you are married, then your marriage is the best environment for spiritual growth that exists on the planet. That makes sense? It does. It's the place of heart transformation. It's God's furnace in which he first shows you your impurities and then refines them out of your life, if you'll let him. That's what he wants to do. Marriage teaches us, after all, to forgive, to be gracious, to give sacrificially. It provides the environment to learn how to respect that person, how to serve them, how to give to them. It consistently presents to us the hardness of our own hearts. Guys, I remember when I was a young man, and that was back, we had our first baby. And that was back when there was no diaper genies, you know, you use cloth diapers, okay? And I tell you, I could not wash a diaper out without screwing up my face. I don't know what happened. I'd go, you know, I just couldn't wash it out without screwing my face up. And anyway, we had one bathroom in the house and at the time. So occasionally I would go into our one bathroom and find a dirty diaper in it that Naomi had placed there. Obviously she hadn't had time, and so she just left it there. But it meant that I could not use the bathroom unless I cleaned out that diaper. I had to clean out the diaper. And I remember with shame my irritation. I remember saying to Naomi, Naomi, come on, it's pretty inconvenient for me to go in there wanting to use the bathroom. I got to clean out a dirty diaper. Rather, why did I not simply think, oh, Naomi didn't have time to wash out the diaper. She has a baby. I'll take care of it. This will help her. Why did I not say that? Any ideas? Selfishness! Yeah, I wish you weren't so quick with that reply. Okay. Yeah, just immaturity, self-centeredness, all of that. We're told to confront the main symptom of immaturity, unselfishness, in 2 Corinthians 5. Look what it says in verse 15. He died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves. Do you think there's an application there in marriage? Think there is? Absolutely. Timothy Keller has a great take on this concept and how it applies to marriage. And though it's a bit long, I want to read it to you because it really cuts to the core here of what we're talking about. He says this, all people need to be treated respectfully and gently, especially those who've been wounded. They will be unusually sensitive to rough handling. And so he's rightly saying that if you are married to a wounded partner, it's true, they need sensitive handling. Nevertheless, he says, all people must be challenged to see that their self-centeredness hasn't been caused by the people who hurt them. It's only been aggravated by the abuse. They must do something about it, or they're going to be miserable forever. In Western culture today, you decide to get married because you feel an attraction to the other person. You think he or she is wonderful. But a year or two later, or just as often a month or two later, three things usually happen. First, you begin to find out how selfish this wonderful person is. Second, you discover that the wonderful person has been going through a similar experience, and he or she begins to tell you how selfish you are. And third, though you acknowledge it in part, you conclude that your spouse's selfishness is more problematic than your own. This is especially true if you feel that you've had a hard life and have experienced a lot of hurt. You say silently, okay, I shouldn't do that, but you don't understand me. The woundedness makes us minimize our own selfishness, and that's the point at which many married couples arrive after a relatively brief period of time. So what do you do then? There are two paths to take. First, you could decide that your woundedness is more fundamental than your self-centeredness and determine that unless your spouse sees the problem you have and takes care of you, it's not going to work out. Of course, your spouse will probably not do this, especially if he or she is thinking almost the exact same thing about you. And so what follows is the development of emotional distance and perhaps a slowly negotiated kind of detente or ceasefire. There is an unspoken agreement not to talk about some things. There are some things your spouse does that you hate, but you stop talking about them as long as he or she will stop bothering you about certain other things. No one changes for the other. There's only a tit-for-tat bargaining. Couples who settle for this kind of relationship may look happily married after 40 years, but when it's time for the anniversary photo op, the kiss will be forced. The alternative, now listen carefully, the alternative to this truce marriage is to determine to see your own selfishness as the fundamental problem and to treat it more seriously than you treat your spouse's. Why? Only you have complete access to your own selfishness, and only you have complete responsibility for it. So each spouse should take the Bible seriously, should make a commitment to give yourself up. You should stop making excuses for selfishness. You should begin to root it out as it's revealed to you, and you should do so regardless of what your spouse is doing. If two spouses each say, I'm going to treat my self-centeredness as the main problem in the marriage, you have the prospect of a truly great marriage. Guys, see why I read that? Pretty confronting, isn't it? And yet it is so true. I've got to think my self-centeredness is the chief problem. I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to handle it. And what will happen if you do that, man? You'll look inside. You'll turn your gaze this way. You'll invite the Lord's gaze. Okay, Lord, you show if any wicked thing remains in my heart. You show me if my hardness is there, Lord. And would you help me now to change my attitudes, my words, my behavior? Guys, that's spiritual growth. That's what brings holiness in our life. Man, we learn to love. There it is. Guys, I challenge you to look inward today. I challenge you to do it. I challenge you to ask yourself, in what ways am I living for myself and failing to love, to live my spouse, to love my spouse? I challenge you to let God use your marriage to show any hardness of your own heart. I even challenge you to talk to your spouse and to say, honey, where do you see self-centeredness in my life? Where have I hurt you? What can I do to change for you? Now, guys, obviously I haven't mentioned friendship, partnership, sexual passion, all these things, but I've gotten very, very close to the foundation, though, of what marriage is about. What I want you to see today is that God's foundational purposes are so key, and if we'll commit to them, it'll make a difference. Let's be clear. Guys, you never marry the right person. Let's just be clear about that. No two people are compatible. It's true. What happens? Two incompatible people vow to love each other, and they stay together long enough until they do. That's what happens. That's God's way. God uses then all of that to transform your heart. But the moment we get confused and follow our culture and think, well, it's got all about my fulfillment, it's all about my what it does for me, that's the moment we give up on the good thing that God wants to see. Guys, we need to see God's purposes. If we'll do that, it'll make a whole big difference in our relationship. And if you're single here today, man, you need to think that through. Am I going to grasp on to what culture says or what God says? And if you're a couple here today, I know that God brought you here through the snow to reconsider what's going on in your heart.
We trust you are inspired and challenged by this message. For additional resources and information about Lighthouse Christian Center and its ministries, check out our website at www.lighthousechristiancenter.com. www.lighthousehome.org or contact us at 253-848-2028.